collections of what's left of sermons is the collection of in the Old Testament that we call the Hebrew prophets, there, or what in the Hebrew canon is called the latter prophets. The former prophets are those, are more discursive narrative historians that we know as 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings. Now, if you think of them as preachers, there are several things about them that are different from contemporary styles of preaching. It isn't fair to judge contemporary preaching by them, because this is a collection of a small collection of preachers from over a 300-year period. You never really have to decide whether you're a prophet. The other people will decide for you after they see whether it happens or not. And so that you have to worry, you know, we have to worry about whether what we say is true. Other people can decide how significant it was. And so that you have here in the Hebrew prophets the gleanings from about 300 or more years of preaching. Couple things in as you begin reading in this collection, a couple things to note. They are much more like a hymn book or like a photograph album than they are like continued narrative or a book of systematic theology. They are small pieces collected together into larger collections, and then very often several larger collections sort of put together in another collection. And so that you will not find continuity of discourse. You'll not find an idea that gets, and part of the fun of, and one of the reasons I chose one particular prophet is because you can see even internal to one figure a tremendous scope. And so that we will be trying to confront the problem. One of the underlying questions is, wherein lies the continuity in the prophet's understanding of Yahweh? You know, if today Yahweh is saying no, and tomorrow Yahweh is saying yes, and we have a fantastic passage, fantastic statement of this in chapter 8 in Isaiah. Yahweh's a sanctuary, and then he's a stumbling block, and then he's a rock of offense, and then he's a trap, and so that you get a very clear idea that for the prophet, Yahweh's always one jump ahead of the community. He's never back. He's never simply back there, and he always. It isn't what Yahweh is doing that is so that the continuity lies in. It's the pertinence of what Yahweh is doing. When the people are secure, Yahweh has an edge. And when the people are helpless, Yahweh is supportive. And so that there's a very subtle kind of continuity that is perceived in Yahweh. And this is part of one of the underlying problems. And if you deal with one prophetic figure, you can see this. So that these are small pieces put together, and rather than, and once one gets exposed to the variety of the witness, then one is in a position to ponder on the continuity. The second thing about them, although only part of the section today is in poetry, you'll notice that a good bit of their preaching is short poetic oracles. So that if one were going to pick out a prophetic type, in terms of how they preach, you'd pick out Graber rather than Hinderle. In other words, much of the stuff that was saved. They didn't save as many of the long, long discourses as they saved the short, poetic, concise images. These were the ones where the form of the message was permanent enough and classic enough to be retained. A lot of us, the message is permanent enough, but the form of the message isn't worth keeping. The form of the traditioning is not intrinsically worth saving. But for most of, so that we find a good bit of this, very concise type of oracle. And I've often, I often thought it would be nice, I sometimes think that there is a certain preacher anxiety when, if you're not sure what you have to say, you say a lot of it. We have a lot of this in college too. My parting words at most final examinations is quality is better than quantity, and quantity is better than nothing. But that needn't be the case in church when you've got hymns and you can read the Bible and do all sorts of other things. It would be nice once in a while to have a really, really concise. I really got caught up short at one of the matins because the fellow said he was going to have a very long sermon, and he said about two sentences about grace, and that was it. And I kept thinking, well, now pretty soon he's going to get to the message. But that was it. It was about two sentences long, and it was very refreshing. And I even remembered it most of the day. Okay. One way of summing up this section, or a simple way of defining one of the thrusts of Isaiah's preaching at this point, I think, is simply to say God's in politics. From Isaiah's point of view, God is involved in the working out of the political events of the life of the nation, and part of Isaiah's job is to interpret the strategy of Yahweh to the people, so that the people will have some sense of the direction of things, and perhaps forge a little different kind of consensus. So, in a way, there's another way of saying it that talks about Isaiah as having theopolitics. But I think the simpler way to say it is that from Isaiah's point of view, God is involved in and interpreting and having some kind of involvement in the working out of the historical process. Now, there are several, in addition to the Yahweh, the hand of Yahweh that Isaiah talks about, there are several characters on the scene in the political situation that you really need to note. For this section in particular, Isaiah is something like a counselor in Judah, which is in the southern, do my doodling, here's the southern kingdom, here's the Mediterranean, Egypt is over here in what is contemporary Iraq is the Assyrian power, and it's Assyria and Egypt that are the major world powers. This is the Fertile Crescent, so to get from Assyria to Egypt, you don't bomb right through Judah. You bomb over, around, and down the coast, which means that Samaria is the buffer to Judah. Now, at this particular time, Samaria and Syria have formed an alliance, and they're coming against Judah, so that you have a Syro-Ephraimite war. Ephraim is the old name for Samaria, and these two have formed a league, and they are attacking and besieging and threatening the king of Judah. So the king of Judah is interested, and you know, they have no power over against this kind of coalition, so that the solution to this particular situation is to try to get the king of Assyria to come over here and pick off the king of Syria. Now, don't confuse us two. Assyria is a major world power, a biggie. Syria is a more regional power between Assyria and Samaria, with the capital is Damascus, the capital of Samaria or Israel. The word Israel is tricky because sometimes it means the whole group and sometimes it just means the northern kingdom. So that roughly the strategy here is to get the king of Assyria to take on these two, but the irony of it is that then the king of Assyria, he gets this far, he doesn't want to stop there, so he might as well just get Judah in his back pocket too, so that he eventually lays siege to Jerusalem, but then there are a number of things going on back at home that he has to break it up and go back. So that you have the very curious, the politics here. Isaiah really sees in the beginning God using Assyria to get this coalition off Judah's back, and then the king of Assyria really gets too big for his britches, and really then God takes Assyria on. And the other interesting thing to note is that clearly for Isaiah, it really doesn't, as far as God's politics, it doesn't really make any difference whether the person knows that God is using them or not. It isn't, from Isaiah's point of view, and you have another section like this in 2 Isaiah, God clearly has a strategy that involves people that are not intimate with him or are not called by his name and do not call upon his name. So we're talking really about God being involved, not simply in the covenant people, not simply in the church, but God being involved in the whole working out of community life. So it's a fairly broad-reaching kind of theological perspective. It's not a theology of the church, in a sense. It's not a theology simply of the chosen people. It's a theology of history. The theology of what God is doing in and with the various people within history. Now, the other thing from yesterday is to get straight on Isaiah's use of Emmanuel. 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 Emmanu. Emmanu is the Hebrew word for near. El is one of the Hebrew words for God. So Emmanuel means simply God is here. God is near. God is with us. Something of that sort. Emmanuel. And it becomes for Isaiah a confession wherever he experiences and sees God's presence. So when the enemies of Judah are defeated, it's Emmanuel. So that, in a sense, there are lots of Emmanuels before we get to Jesus. And when Isaiah talks about Emmanuel, he's talking about God being present in a particular incident close to them, so that it becomes fairly well established when early Christians want to talk about God being close and God being present. They use some of the Emmanuel language and passages. Okay, into verses. Let's begin with verse 9. Here you see a couple of vestiges of longer poems which are embedded in prose narrative. Be broken, you peoples, and be dismayed. Give ear, all you far countries. Gird yourselves and be dismayed. gird yourselves and be dismayed. Notice the thing, listen, far countries, Assyria, Syria, Samaria, Egypt, gird yourselves, get yourselves together. And then notice that the effect of that sort of 30-second sermon, the effect of the 30-second or the one-minute sermon is in the repetition of be dismayed. Be broken and be dismayed. Give ear, gird, and be dismayed. Gird yourselves and be dismayed. Take counsel together, but it won't amount to anything. It will come to naught. Speak a word, but it will not stand. The notes here talks about God, man proposes, God disposes. Isaiah, let's see. There's a considerable gap between planning and intentions and actuality. The historical process includes a large number of variables, one of which is that this is what we want to do, or this is what we ought to do. This is what we ought to do. So that one of the of all the planning and scheming and political programs, only some of them happen. Only some of them really represent an adequate coincidence of good intentions, good planning, effective resources, ultimate meaning, Isaiah saw in the problematicness of implementation. Isaiah saw in the mystery of when what you propose happens and when it doesn't. An action of Yahweh. So that Yahweh is the Lord of limit situations. And when the country proposes an agenda and it fails, then there's something to be learned from that. There's something to be learned from that. And Isaiah sees in this, speak a word, but it will not stand, for God is with us. Isaiah sees in the limitness some protection. In other words, Yahweh protects one people from another. Life is full of schemes. Life is full of schemes, both in the economic sector, in the private sector, in the political sector, in which each person is, or each group, is working out their own theory of how the world ought to be saved, or how their particular part of the universe ought to play a very large part in the universe, whether it ought to be the major company in the economic sector, or whether it ought to be the ecumenical church in the religious sector, or whether I simply ought to be the major figure in my family. There is a scheming and a strategizing which tends to work out so that I or my company or my country is the center of a universe rather than the satellite of a universe. So that one of the major functions of Yahweh in human affairs is limits. Is having an empire that gets too big crumble, and a person who gets too grand stumble, and a country that gets too heroic to be turned around. So that take counsel together, make your plans, but it takes more than planning for something to really happen. There is a component in the processes of life that we don't fully control. So make your plans, speak a word, but it won't necessarily stand. Okay, so Isaiah sees in Yahweh's lordness of limit situations a real providence for Israel. Verse 11, "For the Lord spoke thus to me with his strong hand upon me and warned me not to walk in the way of this people. Do not call conspiracy all that the people call conspiracy, and do not fear what they fear, nor be in dread. But the Lord of hosts, him you shall regard as holy. Let him be your fear, let him be your dread." We tend to classify fear as a negative thing, and confidence as a good word. Fear is a negative word, confidence is a good word. For Isaiah and most of the prophets, it's not fear and confidence that are at opposite ends of each other. It's different kinds of fear and different qualities of fear. So that in this verse, the fear of conspiracy, or maybe we should make the distinction here between anxiety, between terror, between respect, which is a kind of fear, and sort of plain fears. Well, I suppose we'd say that he is saying that the anxiety that sees in it conspiracy, this kind of dread is a misplaced kind of fear. That you really, finally, there is more, you need to be more aware of not the little enemy on the horizon, but the long-term will of Yahweh for human history. There's a real dynamics, you see. If America gets afraid of Russia, and all the behavior is motivated by this particular short-term situation, then we're really acting out of panic, out of anxiety, out of a fear of a particular concrete situation, rather than acting out of a long-term vision of what we ought to be contributing to the processes of history. And finally, the security and integrity of a particular country is not determined by what they're afraid of, but by what they contribute to the history of the people. So that if we defend ourselves against quote unquote the communists and turn around and lose the respect of the whole world because of defensive behavior and anxiety, we end up sort of way over here by ourselves, it being perfectly clear to every other country in the world that we're only worried about the skin off our own back. And we cannot be trusted. We cannot be trusted to be concerned about the affairs of the third world or the ongoing cultivation of a worldwide human community. So short-term anxiety, to be afraid only of Assyria and of the army that's on your doorstep. To be only afraid of the army on your doorstep and not of the overall will of Yahweh for human life is a misplaced kind of fear. It's not the kind of fear that will lead to long, to building a... Same thing really happens in our pollution anxieties. It seems to me like we have one pollution anxiety over another, you know, and the first thing comes along, we've got to save this, and before you know it, we've made such a big mess saving this that we've got another one. And so we're just hopping from one pollution pile to another, you know, and it's a kind of our policy, we get up into a panic policy. So Isaiah is really, really saying, don't call conspiracy all that this people call conspiracy, and do not fear what they fear, nor be in dread. Don't really get carried away with all the panic talk, with the hysteria that overwhelms a nation about this little thing and that little thing. But the Lord of hosts, him you shall regard as holy, let him be your fear, let him be your dread. If Yahweh, as the source of goodness and justice and power, is what you really respect, then this enables you to judge and measure the other things of life. So that if your long-term respect and anxiety rests on the revelation of being and transcendence in human experience, then you have a measure against which to take and assess and develop some judgment about the circumstances around you. Now this next verse is a neat verse. And he will become a sanctuary and a stone of offense and a rock of stumbling to both houses of Israel, a trap and a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Remember that verse in Hebrews? I just want to underline that first couple. In many and diverse ways. In many and diverse ways God spoke to his people. And I for one, want to... I'm trying very hard to shout quietly about the variety of ways that Yahweh uses. I think we have come out of an era where we always expect Yahweh to sound like the King James Bible, or like the preacher, like to have the voice of the preacher after he said, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. You know, that certain kind of tone that we get when we're in the middle of the sermon, that what they used to call the praedicatona, you know. And it was a good tone, you know. They could hear you in the back of the church, and it let people... In the old days, it really meant that about this part of what you were saying, you had really worked very hard to present not simply what you wanted to say, but what ought to be said. And there's a difference, because I don't always want to say what I say. I mean, there are things that one needs to say that one doesn't want to say, and the old, but it doesn't mean that anymore. It just means that you had a speech teacher 20 years older than this sort of thing. So it just doesn't mean that anymore. But we keep hearing Yahweh as having one voice. And the interesting thing, I think, about Isaiah is that, in a sense, the whole writing of Isaiah is a message from Yahweh. But when you look, inspect it, you discover that Yahweh has several voices. Sometimes he speaks like a priest. Sometimes he speaks like a lawyer. The prophet has several voices. So, wake up a little, or tune in. You never, never really know in advance where you will hear the living voice of Yahweh. the precedents, his old words will help us recognize his new words. His old words will help us recognize his new words, so that there's a real relationship between Scripture and hearing Yahweh in the present. But the words and the echo of these words can happen almost any place. And in this verse, and he will become a sanctuary and a stone of offense and a rock of stumbling to both houses of Israel and a trap and a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And many shall stumble thereon, and they shall fall and be broken, and they shall be snared and taken. The other corrective that I see in this perspective is that clearly for Isaiah, Yahweh is the source of support and limit. The source of support and the source of limits. He is both sanctuary and snare. And it's a great if we interpret love as we have tended to do in some Christian pieties and spiritualities in recent years, if we interpret love totally as tenderness, totally as affirmation, we will abandon, we will leave limits and struggle and crisis to the demons and to the wastelands. Now the prophets looked at that differently. Clearly, the care and support and tenderness of Yahweh, the forgiveness, the providence, the daily bread, all of that comes out of the hand of Yahweh. But also the limits. Yahweh is sanctuary and snare. Sometimes we are so wrapped up in our direction and so caught up that the only way we'll be turned around is by a trap. Sometimes we're so bent on a course of events that does not have the best interests of the world at stake, that the only way to limit that the only solution is limits. So that The love of Yahweh is expressed both as Lord of sanctuary and comfort and praise, and as Lord of limits. Let's get on with the next oracle, which really this means of course that you can't predict which Yahweh's going to be. I keep planning. I have it all figured out, that I'm helpless and I really need the comfort. And I keep asking for the nice tender thing, and then all of a sudden I keep getting things. Do it. Quit. Do it. And so don't be surprised, or be ready to be surprised. Be ready to be surprised, because Yahweh may be addressing you in the opposite situation than you expect. In the opposite situation. So be ready. We need to listen long enough so that the the meanings, these curious meanings that happen. And if you expect to hear them in church, you know, you may hear them in the doctor's office instead. And if you expect to hear them in the doctor's office, maybe you better listen twice in church. Because this is the thing. I get a bit concerned on the one hand, Yahweh is very consistent, so we have a right to talk about the consistency of Yahweh and put an emphasis on the responsibility of us as humans. But there's another side to it, and that's that Yahweh is free and he's surprising. And he's surprising. So that we need to be ready to probe the things that we don't understand and don't expect. All right, in 16, bind up the testimony and seal the teaching among my disciples. I will wait for the Lord who's hiding his face from the house of Jacob, and I will hope. Curious language. Curious language. Yahweh's there, but, you know, it's something like the, we have to finish our conversation. Luther and I have been having a pretty good conversation about whether Yahweh's, whether we can talk about the absence of the presence of Yahweh. And that's an open question. That's an open question in the modern period, because it's extremely important that people deal with their own insensitivity to the presence of Yahweh that is really there. There are a lot of people in the world who are walking around with dark glasses and they don't know the sun's out. You know? And it's terribly important to help people take off their dark glasses and help people take off their rose-colored glasses and help them deal with life the way it is. But there are days, I would argue, there are days when there is a cloud in front of the sun. And there are cultures and cultural periods where there is a cloud in front of the sun, or at least in Isaiah's time, a fruitful way to talk about certain kinds of periods was the Lord who is hiding his face from the house of Jacob. Now, that doesn't mean that Yahweh has, I think you're right in challenging me on language of abandonment, because hiding the face does not mean that Yahweh has ceased to be Yahweh. It doesn't mean that he has abandoned his power and his providence. But it might not be as clear, or it might not be as visible, and the purpose of it might not be clear in the public square. So that there is, Isaiah is really committing himself to the long haul. In the short haul, it's panic about Assyria, hurry up and build the walls higher, hurry up and really politic, short-term politics, and Isaiah's waiting. I will hope in him, and it's interesting. I think this is a neat one. 18, behold, I and the children whom the Lord has given me are signs and portents in Israel from the Lord of hosts who dwells on Mount Zion. Sometimes you get to be prophets and carry the message, and everybody hears the message, and sometimes all you can be is saints and just be there. You know, Isaiah is saying, you know, he's carried the message and they don't pay any attention to him. Now all he can do is he and his kids with the funny names can just be there and exhibit a different lifestyle. So that there is a time when all you can do is shut up and live in terms of the long-term Yahweh consciousness. Live in terms of the long-term Yahweh consciousness and wait. Wait till people can take the message and the sign and the circumstances and put it together. I think one of the fascinating examples from the history of missions, I think it was the old Noyan Detelzau mission in Indonesia, where a fellow came out. Does anybody remember his name? fellow came out from Germany and decided that the mission work wasn't getting any place. They weren't paying any attention to the social structure of the Batak people. So that he went and he lived in a village for a year without doing anything. And then they set up a mission program where a Christian family went to another village, got permission to live in the village and live as Christians. And they just lived there until the headman of the tribe would ask them, well, will you teach? No, we cannot teach unless you send for a teacher. And you cannot have a teacher come unless you agree to change the laws of the tribe so that the people who believe the teachings can live as Christians. See, because the big problem in the missions with the tribal folk is that we, coming from a highly individualistic society, didn't have a full enough appreciation of the tribal character of the people, and so the Christians would be wrenched out of their kinship structure. So that this whole strategy forced, no teaching was done until the headman asked for the teacher, and nobody was baptized until the laws were changed so that you could live as a Christian without giving up your place in your society and in your family and in your kinship structure. And as a result, and that strategy start, the beginning of that strategy was simply to be a sign, be a family living Christian lifestyle but not teaching anything, to heighten the consciousness by example rather than by language. And there are periods, and we may be in one of them, where there are so many words that words get to not be worth much. There's a kind of deflation in the evocativeness of language because of the torrent and quantity of language that we face on every front. So that as a result of that particular strategy, one of the major and largest Lutheran churches in the world is in Indonesia. Not in Germany or Sweden or Norway or America, but in Indonesia. And it happened because there was a strategy that converted the people rather than individuals. So it had in it this kind of sign business. Now this next part is, behold, I and the children whom the Lord dwell in Mount Zion. And when they say to you, consult the mediums and wizards who chirp and mutter, should not a people consult their God? Of course. But should they consult the dead on behalf of the living? Should they consult the dead on behalf of the living? People will believe, when they're frightened enough, they'll believe almost anything. And we do. We absolutely do. We're living, I'm telling you, I think the 20th century is exactly like the second century. We've got our mystery cults over here. We've got our emperor cults over here. We've got our spiritual Christians and our spiritual humanists. And we've got, you know, the right way to say it, we've got every damn thing, religiously. And in our own backyards and sometimes in our own families. And it's a bit much. It's a bit much. And almost all of these groups begin with some appeal to anxiety, some appeal to insecurity, some appeal to helplessness. And Isaiah's pragmatic answer is that should they consult the dead on behalf of the living? So one item here is, I suspect that a lot of our children have viewed our understanding of Yahweh as consulting the dead. We have talked so much about Yahweh's footprints in Palestine and so little about Yahweh's footprints in the in our own country that it had. I think that this has been one factor, and there are a number of others. The second thing he says, to the teaching and to the testimony, surely for this the word which they speak, there is no dawn. The romantic, sentimental pieties come and go, but they are not taking account of the continuities and forces of human history in the same way that Torah and the classic understandings of the unity of God do. They tend to take account of the providences, but not the limits, and to not be able to deal with the limits. And one of the measures of whether a religious community like Christianity or Judaism or Islam, whether these religious communities survive is whether they last over 1,000 years, and you don't last longer than 100 or 200 or 300 years without perceiving the hand of Yahweh, the hand of God, in limit situations. The test of the word is not simply how they deal with weakness, but how they in comfort, but how they deal with the limits. And they will pass through the land greatly distressed and hungry, and when they are hungry they will be enraged and will curse their king and their God and turn their faces upward, and they will look to the earth, but behold distress and darkness, the gloom of anguish, and they will be thrust into thick darkness. For Isaiah, long-term perceptiveness was out of the intelligibility and rationality of the teaching of Yahweh. And the fancies and even the comforts of the moment he really didn't think would last very long. And he thought that they wouldn't provide direction for dealing with the actual crises that confronted the nation and confronted the nations with each other. Tomorrow we pick up with Isaiah 9, and we begin to talk about the vision of the end of history. You may want to argue with Isaiah. It's quite clear from the Old Testament that the Lord loved a good argument, and I'm sure Isaiah would love a good argument, and I like a good argument. One of the things that's hidden in this passage is a clear assertion of Yahweh being on the side of rationality rather than superstition. And I've grown up in an era that identified Yahweh with believing, you know, faith was believing what was unintelligible. When you couldn't understand it, then you believed. And you know, I happen to think that Yahweh is the whole point of Revelation, is that there are some things about Yahweh that are very intelligible, very reasonable, maybe not able to be justified simply rationally, but still fairly rational. And as justifiable as most of the crap that people believe.